So, hello and welcome to the Poetry Pause, a podcast from a cowshed in West Wales. This episode, we're looking at Imtiaz Darke, which is very exciting. And we have Emma Baines here, Emma Nailit Baines. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Louise Thomas, who is a published poet. She's our guest this episode. So before we get into the poem and its choice, how have we been using poetry during lockdown? Because we've just come out of lockdown here, haven't we, in Wales?
Yes. Yeah. Mm.
So, Emma, have you been using any particular poems to help you? Or
I've been dipping in and out, opening books randomly, reading whatever poem I land on. And I think there's always something to help you in any poem, so I've enjoyed doing that.
Sort of randomly.
Random. Mm.
Random poems.
Yeah.
What about you, Louise?
Well, pretty much the same for me too. I have found it quite difficult to read prose, either fiction or non-fiction, but I've always been able to just read a poem or two. And I have strategic poetry books. I always have one by the toilet.
You did.
So that, because you've always got just enough time to read a poem. So very much like Emma, really. Not specifically for solace or consolation, but just to lift you out of yourself, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so now, Lou, you're a member of our poetry workshop.
Indeed.
What brought you to poetry originally? Because you're quite an experienced poet, aren't you?
Well, I don't know what brought me to poetry, really. I've written poetry ever since I could write, from a very young age. And then I branched into songwriting. But even when I was songwriting, I was always writing poems at the same time. You know, I would know whether it was going to be a song or a poem, because if it were a song, it would come with a tune. If it were a poem, it wouldn't. And interestingly, my poetry hardly ever rhymes, but my songs do.
Right.
So I've just done it all my life.
Yeah. Since from when you were a small child.
Yes, I have a little story.
Go on then.
Okay, so people often say to me, oh, well, you must enter this competition and you must do that. And I have never wanted to compete. And I think that stems back to when I think I was seven, we were doing a project at school. I went to a central London school as a small child on Malta. And I wrote a poem about Malta, which sadly is no longer extant, but I think it probably had something to do with lace making and something to do with emerald shores, probably. Mm-hmm. And I handed it to the teacher, and she was very angry. And she said, no, I can't possibly put this on the board. You've copied this from a book.
Oh.
And after that, I never showed my poems to anybody until recently.
Right.
So I think that really, it made me feel humiliated and ashamed, and the injustice as well, really.
Yes.
That this teacher wouldn't take my work seriously.
Yes. Mm. Yes, it's interesting that, isn't it? Because I wrote a poem in school about Powell's Fish and Chip Shop, which was a place our family spent quite a lot of time. And that was greeted with horror by the English teacher, you know, the choice of subject. And it does put you off a bit, I think. Anyway, so your choice now, would you like to tell us what it is, please, and why you've chosen it?
Yes, I have chosen Litter by Imtiaz Darke. I particularly like this poem because it gives us hope. Imtiaz famously has written so many poems of grief about the loss of her husband, Simon Powell. And in this one, we come out at the end of it realising that grief is something that can be managed and that you can live with and is necessary to live with and is not necessarily a bad or awful thing.
Well, could you read it, please?
Litter by Imtiaz Darke. At Derby Station, on the pavement where you stood, I leave your shoes. At Sheffield, In the cafe where you sat, I leave the orange scarf. On the Liverpool ferry, I leave your overcoat by the freezing rail where you pointed out Hope Street. On Hope Street, at the traffic lights between the two cathedrals, I leave your photograph. On the platform at Euston, your suitcase with green tags. At the front door, I leave grieving. Coming in, I say your name. Saying your name, I bring you home.
Lovely, thank you. Okay, Emma, what do you reckon?
It's just a beautiful poem. I love the title. It's literally a throwaway title. And just the layers of grief being shed throughout. It's just a lovely way of coming to terms with something. And again, as we've discussed before with other poems, using tangible objects, the everyday, to connect with a person and to connect with the reader. Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a lovely poem, isn't it? Do you want to say any more about
it? Yeah, well, I just think that... I think the distillation of an emotion or an experience is at the heart of all poetry, really. I think that's why it's a format that I enjoy writing in. And I think somebody said that poems don't belong to the writers, they belong to the people who need them. And that's why poetry is so often used in grief situations, for funerals, etc. You need something distilled, accessible, and you need something identifiable. And tokens of one form or another are exactly what people do when they're bereaved. You know, that you've only got to think about the flowers left at roadsides and on school fences, palace gates. You know, that's what we do. And ultimately, that's what a tombstone is. It is that physical reminder that this person lived. I mean, my mother was mad about graveyards, and I got dragged around and we read tombstones incessantly. That has filtered down to me with memorial benches. I love memorial benches. And I will always sit and think, oh, hello, I wonder who you were. And I think this, her wanting to leave something tangible of him in all of these very significant places for them and their relationship, it's such a human thing.
And it is a really, really lovely poem, I think. Can we talk a little bit now about Imtiaz? What do we know about her, Emma? What do we know about her? She's a very interesting character.
She is a very interesting character. She thinks of herself as a kind of, or has been described as a cultural mongrel with Pakistani, Scottish, Welsh connections. I think that everyone is kind of influenced by the little bits they cherry pick through life, and it becomes part of their unique experience. And I think she sees her role as a poet to kind of transcend this, or to use these experiences to speak to everyone, to speak to the universal. And she says herself, poetry tries to interpret the heartbeat of the world. I think through her own unique experience, she's able to speak not only for herself, but for all people and the shared experience that we all have.
Because she was brought up in Glasgow, wasn't she?
She was, yes.
In a Muslim family.
Yeah, yes, they came over from Pakistan, is where she was born.
And she fell in love with Anil Darker?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether she fell in love with him. Possibly. He was her tutor.
Yeah.
And he proposed to her almost immediately after she graduated, I think, on the day at that ceremony.
Yes, gosh.
And she made that decision to elope with him within hours or less. So obviously they had a relationship beforehand.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think very much part of her decision must have been that it was her ticket to freedom.
All right.
Because she said herself that she had freedom to learn and to advance herself, but she didn't have freedom to go out like any other Glaswegian
child,
woman. So I think there must have been a degree of, because he was quite considerably older than her, I think.
Yes.
As well, not that that makes any difference, but.
He was also Hindu, wasn't he? Mm. That which is the big cruncher, I think, probably as far as her family were concerned. So and she was estranged then from her family, wasn't she?
Yes, she was estranged from her family. And I don't know if she had thought that it would be lifelong. I don't think for one moment she thought it would be lifelong. But she never saw her mother again. Mm. And tragically, so poignantly, she kind of intercepted her father at an airport. And he initially didn't recognise her. And that was the only contact she ever had with her father, just as he was going to catch a plane, for her to just literally sort of ambush him.
Gosh.
And say, here I am.
Yeah, in flight kind of thing. Gosh, how very... sad.
Very sad.
And she was in Mumbai for about 30 years, wasn't she?
Mm.
And then she came to speak, did she?
She came for Poetry Live. She was invited to come and read at Poetry Live.
Which
was the huge festival for GCSE students set up by Simon Powell. And I believe they actually met on the Liverpool ferry when he went to meet her, you know, as a speaker. And that's when their romance began. And of course, that again, I describe her as a very self-determinant person.
Mm.
You know, when she met Simon Powell, I don't know if his wife Shan had died, but certainly it would have been very shortly after. She knew that Simon Powell was terminally ill.
Mm.
And yet she embarked on that marriage with him. And I think he was the love of her life.
Mm, mm.
But again, she probably was flying in the face of convention because it couldn't have been many months between Shan dying and her and Simon getting married.
Mm, mm. Wow, she is definitely extremely decisive, isn't she?
Yes, yes. And there's a very, well, I don't know if anybody else would pick it up, but there was a very slight hint, I felt. Carol Ann Duffy wrote an elegy for Simon Powell after he died. And she says in the poem, "Who did you beguile on that ferry in Liverpool? A poetry girl. Well, well. You were ever poetry's best pal." Now, to me, there's a very slight hint of,
Yes, yes.
Because she then later refers to the death of Shan, you know, in a familiar way, as if they were friends. I don't know.
Yes, well, it's quite interesting to describe somebody who might be a peer as a girl, isn't it? It's an interesting description.
Yes. And obviously, even if there were any hint of disapproval, then that was it was healed, because Carol Ann Duffy is just absolutely a fan of Imchaz and put her forward as her natural successor.
Mm. Yeah.
And in fact suggested that if there were a world poet laureate, it should be Imchaz Darza.
Yeah, and they went on tour, didn't they, with Julian Clarke? And, great. Okay, now she took another tough decision, didn't she, about the poet laureateship. Do you want to say anything about that,
Ella? She stepped away. She stepped away from being considered for poet laureate to focus on her work, which just, this is what sticks with me more than anything else, just her courage to do what's right for her. Her determination is just, I know very few people who are that certain of themselves and will prioritise what's truly right for them above anything else. It's just incredible. Yeah.
It's interesting, the poet laureateship gig, isn't it? Because I think you're paid about sort of $5,750 or something
a year. It's peanuts, yeah.
Which Carol Ann Duffy, as we mentioned in a previous episode, gave to set up the Ted Hughes Prize. So it's not much money. And then you're given a sack of sherry.
A sack of sherry.
600 quid's worth of sherry.
Yeah.
So you'd obviously want relatives or friends would pick on sherry. It's archaic, isn't it?
Simon Armitage is making quite a big deal about it, and his the poet laureate has gone to his shed podcast type thing. Everybody that comes gets offered some sherry.
But just the lack of ego, you know, like that level of status and people being aware that you are the poet laureate.
Yes, yeah.
That would be, for many people,
irresistible.
Yeah. Irresistible, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because you have got to a certain extent, uphold the establishment, haven't you? You have to create poems and work around kind of royal events and things like that.
I think that's an expectation. I think I read somewhere that you don't, you know, there's no law that says you have to write poems for the royal family or whatever. Yeah. But it is an expectation.
Yeah. Caroline Duffy was quite clever because she made some of those very communal events, didn't she? So, I mean, I was thinking, would I turn it down? And actually, I think I'm Welsh, I'm Republican. I probably would, because I wouldn't be able to write, not that I'm in line to be asked, but I wouldn't be able to write flattering poems.
No.
If, you know, Kate popped out another baby or something like that. So there you go. We haven't mentioned she won the very prestigious Queen's Medal in 2014, which had previously been won by W.H. Auden, Philip Larkin and Ted Hughes. So she's in very esteemed company there. What is especially distinctive about her work, or how would you kind of describe it, her body of poetry? Any ideas?
Well, for me, I would say that it's her ability to translate the everyday into poetry.
Mm.
She highlights dilemmas and the choices that we all make, possibly without even being aware of them. Mm. So, for example, in The Right Word, which is another poem that's on the GCSE syllabus, she is constantly saying, oh, no, have I got that right? And she's using a different word for this person that is standing outside her door. And we go through terrorist, freedom fighter, until we get down to a boy who looks like your son too. And then the child steps in. So she distills it down. She takes us, she almost talks us down from a terrorist situation into some little waif and stray that she invites into her home to eat food.
Yes.
And that, I think, she's a human poet.
Yes.
Everything is stripped down to humanity.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's very significant that Neil Astley has recently published his most recent book in the Staying Alive series. This one's called Staying Human. And it's quite a hefty tome. And she has no fewer than 12 poems selected in there. That's three more than any other poet. So, you know, if he's calling it Staying Human, I think that points out that she is a human poet.
Yes. I mean, you can really hear, I think, why her poems, because quite a few of them are on the school curriculum, aren't there? Yeah. There's a very funny YouTube video by a very helpful teacher called Mr. Buff.
Oh, yes.
Where he takes kids through Tissue, which I think is quite a difficult poem for kids. And you can tell, he has a lot of chat with the kids, helping them, giving them an interpretation about it. But that is, it seems to me, you know, quite far out in terms of abstraction. Much of her work is very grounded. I especially love that poem about she must be from another country, because she deals a lot with that, doesn't she? Mm. Issues to do, which are extremely relevant today, culture, identity, being a woman from a Muslim background, you know. And this one has this wonderful verse. When I pee in the vineyard as if it were Bombay, flaunting my bare arse, covering my face, laughing through my hands, they'll turn away, shake their heads quite sadly. She doesn't know any better, they'll say. She must be from another country. I mean, kids must just love that.
Absolutely.
It's so visual and earthy, isn't it? Literally earthy. So, anything else about her?
I feel like she deals with the nuts and bolts of life. She's not ethereal in any way. She writes in a very eloquent and beautifully put together way, but she's dealing with hard-hitting issues, a lot of the time political issues. You just described there about the Queen's Medal. You know, among those kind of older male white poets, there she is. So, you know, that in itself is very political. And I think she presents herself in a kind of very beautiful way. But she's strong, she's tough.
Yes.
You know, and she's not afraid to write about those things.
Yeah.
She is, but also, she's also quite soft. You know, I think about the poem about her dad being so proud to be able to pronounce the word loch. Mm. Look, hen, the loch. And also, she writes about a simple scene of Simon and one of his poetry mates in a cafe and she writes about the ordinary and the personal as well, which is why it's so surprising sometimes when she is so very political and she's tackling things. But The Terrorist at My Table, all of those poems are to do with that kind of issue.
She doesn't. I mean, it was interesting because when we were preparing this, we had a discussion about, does she have grace or not? And I think maybe grace is the wrong word. But she's extremely poised, isn't
she? There's incredibly poised,
I mean, I love listening to her reading. It's theatrical, but it's also controlled, and she has the most lovely voice and rhythm to her delivery. She's very beautiful to listen and look at.
But she is very graceful. You know, I met her very briefly at Torbay Poetry Festival last year, and her speaking voice is very similar to her performing voice, which is a plus for me. I hate people putting on their special poetry voice. But she, as you say, she's very poised. She's very self-contained, but she is also very gracious.
Yeah.
You know, she will interact with you and have an ordinary chat about breakfast or her train journey that's coming up. I understand why people call it grace,
yes,
but I think graceful,
yes,
is more to the point. But she's also extremely self-contained. I really feel that she doesn't let anybody know anything she doesn't want them to. She's very private.
Yes, and that might be another motive for not being poet laureate, actually, especially with the Hindu-Muslim dimension.
Yeah.
You might not want people to go there, you know. I think her daughter's an actress, isn't she? Do you know what I mean? You kind of would be aware that your privacy risked violation.
I think she actually used those words about turning it down, that she weighed up the privacy that she needs to write her poetry, and the poetry won.
Well, yeah, I think that the poetry says what she wants to say. This is, you know, this is her truth.
Yeah.
You don't need to be on display personally as a, you know, a person all the time.
There's two other things about her that I think are interesting. One is, I think it must have been on Desert Island Discs, she describes her working hours, preferred working hours, and they are from 11 in the evening till 4 in the morning.
Oh, wow. Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yes. She writes best at night. She starts at 11 and often works through till about 4 in the morning. So that's an interesting perspective. And the other thing is, of course, that she's an acclaimed documentary maker, isn't she?
Yes. Now, I tried to find a film to watch, but I couldn't. Then don't seem to be available generally. I'd be fascinated to watch one of her films.
I mean, there is a clip on YouTube of her in Mumbai talking about the poem she wrote about water.
The Blessing.
Which is just such a wonderful poem.
It is.
And I kind of got the sense watching that video, I think it was on the BBC, actually, I'll put the links in the notes, but I just got the sense, though, I'm sure her documentaries are really great, the way she covered this subject, you know, and there were clips of kind of kids.
But so many of her poems are very cinematic, aren't they? You can, you know, you can absolutely understand that she also makes film because you can see so many of her poems as you read.
Yeah.
Well, the like the poem Blessing, you know, illustrates the point I was making before. It's so beautifully written. The imagery is beautiful. The skin cracks like a pod. There is never enough water. and then the liquid Suriname polished to perfection. The words, the language is beautiful, but it's documenting something. It's telling us about a horrible, hard-hitting situation.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that she illustrates something beautifully, but is making a political statement at the same time.
And indeed, in this film, you're left in no doubt it was an actual incident that happened to her. She was filming in the slums of Mumbai and she saw this happening and that was her response.
And all of these things are intertwined as well. You know, she says that she never knows when she puts a line on the page if it's going to be a poem or a drawing. And again, the documentary, they overlap and intertwine, which I suppose is what great art is. You make something beautiful that shares something else, doesn't it? Something that's touched you in some way.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned the art, have we? But the art is obviously very distinctive because it's on all her book covers.
Yeah,
well, and inside the book as well. And she says somewhere, the drawings don't illustrate the poems, but they amplify them. And that's true. And often the drawings have the poems integrated into them, don't they?
Yes,
which is great. She is a remarkable woman.
Yeah, I love it when those poems are integrated. She's stunningly talented, really, isn't she? It's not fair. Anyway, okay, should we try our responses now?
Okay.
So, Lou, as guest, would you like to go first?
Oh, okay, thank you. Right, so I was very interested in, you know, the remembering of people. I'm firmly of the opinion that people live on in our memories. And so it got me thinking, how would I like to be remembered and where would I be taken? So I wrote this in response to Litta. Take me with you. Don't leave me behind. Take me with you. Up the hill to breathe in the view, or stride along the wind-hurling beach, taking the pulse of the tide. Stand with glass in hand in the garden's last patch of sun by the wall of old stone. Dance me around the kitchen to the beat of boiling spuds. Tell me silly jokes, hear my laugh. Curl up with me and the cats purring in and out. Say my name. Keep me in mind.
Lovely. What do you think, Emma?
I think that it's like the other side of the coin from Litta. You know, that was about the act of letting go and leaving or being reminded of somebody in different places. This is the bits we keep of somebody, the bits that are still living all around us, and it is just an absolutely beautiful poem.
Well, thank you.
And it's very childlike, isn't it, taking me with you? But that feeling never leaves us, you know. I love the spuds and the cats. I mean, it's just so sort of grounded in real life. When we finish these responses, we must talk to you a little bit about your collection and how you got it together, actually, because this is the last poem in your collection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great. So be good to know a bit more about that. But no, it's really lovely, Lou. Fab title as well, Take Me With You.
Thank you.
All right, Emma.
Trinkets. Funny. I felt I never knew you till I found your gauze-wrapped gallstone at the bottom of a cup, your nuts and bolts laid bare as they lay you out. Till I found your gauze-wrapped gallstone and they sponged your fingers with soap and care, laid bare as they lay you out. I never held your gut in my hand. And they sponged your fingers with soap and care as we all drank tea in your kitchen. I never held your gut in my hand till you pulled the gut from me as we all drank tea in your kitchen. At the bottom of a cup, your nuts and bolts, till you pulled the gut from me. Funny, I felt I never knew you.
Wow, that's amazing. It's It's amazing when you hear a poem, isn't it? It often has, I think, a much stronger effect than just reading it on the page. Because I'd seen that poem before we met, but I had no idea of how many refrains and echoes there were in it. Actually, it's really fantastic rhythm, and it's almost like the tide, isn't it?
I think it's an exceptionally well-crafted poem, and as is often the case with your poetry, Emma, unusual, a completely different angle, and quite shocking in a way. And this is speaking as a mother who still has her child's umbilical cord wrapped up and all of her baby teeth. But that image was just so, it's so intimate and so weird. And I just think it's absolutely great. One of the great things about it is that it makes me want to know more about this person that's being laid out, and the poet's relationship with this person. You know, the kernel of something that actually assisted in keeping that person alive, being on the exterior, you know, presumably had been removed in life. It's just weird and wonderful and great. I just love it.
Because you don't think of trinkets as being body parts, do you?
No.
So, yes, I wanted to know more about the person. Are you going to tell us?
It's my grandmother, and she did keep her gallstone in some gauze at the bottom of a cup. And, you know, I just, in some ways, I never felt I really got to the bottom of her, and she didn't really get to the bottom of me. And I suppose it's about regret and the rhythms of life, and how you can be very familiar with someone through the everyday and know nothing really about who they were, who they, you know, who they thought they were and who they really were. So, yeah, I find it quite interesting how you can know somebody intimately and not really know them at all. And then you just find little reminders of them. Mm. So, yeah, I thought it was an interesting way of illustrating that, the repetition, the form of the poem.
And do you think that happens more with family?
Yeah, definitely.
Because they're always there, you take them for granted, whereas with your friends and your partners, you make the effort
to get to know them. You make connections based on things that you share with people that you're not related to. But with your relatives, they're just as they are. They're almost part of the furniture. Mm-hmm. And until they're gone, maybe you don't really understand what you didn't know about them, or you didn't spend the time finding out.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing is as well, is that, I mean, for instance, as parents, it's very satisfying to see traits in your children that you think you have that are good. But of course, your children may also have traits of yours that are bad, and it's kind of the shadow side, as Jung called it. And we don't want to know those. We need a certain amount of distance. And of course, kids often do not want to be like their parents at all, to be reminded, oh, I was just like you at that age. It's kind of the worst thing they can hear, because they want to be making their own identity and are sort of free of any of those influences that DNA may have. It's very interesting dynamic, isn't it? It's a constant tightrope we're on in all our relationships, how close and how distant we are, how dependent on each other. But that's very, really interesting.
Shall we hear yours?
Yes, Pepper? Yeah. Lua. St. Pancras clock, he says, like old rom-com movie. Smooch in the Uber, she says, like first date teenagers. Chelsea Hotel, he says, we'll talk in present tenses. Chateaubriand, she says, to our romance of the rare. Pomerol, he says, berry dark and spice. 900 thread sheets, she says, for slide and shimmy. Le Labo Rose, he says, can't keep my hand still. Position number 5, she says, let me straddle you. Is that a knife, he said?
It's dark, Pepper.
When I read this, it made me laugh out loud. And it's just, I just thought of your other series of poems about hotel breakfasts. And I just wondered, did she go down to breakfast the next morning?
There could be a sequel, couldn't there?
Yeah. I love it. I love the title. It's so intriguing.
Yes. And to be honest, when I started reading it, I thought, where's she going with this now? And how has this been inspired by Im Chazzy's poem? But it's just, it is very you, my dear.
Thank you.
I can see how it is influenced.
Absolutely. It's places and going from one place to the other and one situation to the next, you know.
Yeah. Well, like sort of reality TV shows, you know, Im Chazzy's poem is a journey, isn't it? Yes. It's very clearly a journey. Yes. So I thought I would use a journey. I thought I'd have, this is very literal and tangible, I'd have a poem that started with L, like litter.
Okay.
And I'd have objects on the journey. But I was also struck by, I was listening to some, you know, poetry expert who said poems don't really tell stories, which I don't agree with anyway, because I think ballads do. So I thought, oh, I'm going to try and tell a story in this, you know. So that's what I did. And, I'm interested in crime writing and things like that. So I did a bit grand guignol with a knife at the end.
You sink into it and it becomes very warm and alive, and then it's just cut off. I love the way it's just.
She's run out. Oh no.
But I actually think for people who are learning to write poetry, this litter is a fantastic example of a poem to study because of the tangible nature of it. But back to the YouTube video, I was really empathizing with the kids when they couldn't get to grips with the abstract nature. I find abstract poetry very difficult.
One poor child made a comment, if this comes up on the paper, I will use it to wipe my tears.
Oh,
poor love.
Yes.
And I marked GCSE higher level papers as well. And one at the bottom of one question, there was nothing there. She just said, I can't do this. It's too difficult. I felt so sad. I gave her 2 marks for that.
So were you an English teacher?
Yeah.
All right. And you taught in secondary schools?
I did, yes. Yeah. I started out in primary, but then I went into secondary and I taught English and drama.
They were all so different, these responses, weren't they?
Yes.
Which I think is a sign of a really great poem. So let's just talk a little bit before we finish off what Im Chazzy's means to us in a kind of nutshell. But can you tell us a little bit about getting your collection together? Because I'm very interested that this poem, it comes from a collection that is all about Simon Powell, isn't it? And how she dealt with the death.
Yeah, Over the Moon. Yes, there's a lot of more general poems at the beginning of the work. And then, interestingly, there are 2 blank pages. And then she writes a poem about, I should write it, stab the page, where she obviously has to start writing. Yes, so then the latter part of the book is mostly about her dealing with her grief. Yeah, so it's a very interesting collection, I think.
Yeah, so when you did your collection, because you are quite distinctive, so you've been a teacher of English and you live on a farm, you're a farmer's wife.
Yes.
As well as being a poet. Did that affect what poems you put in the collection, or how did you choose your collection? It has got a theme, hasn't it? Because it's called...
Yeah, I specifically decided that I would collect together the poems that dealt with life, love and loss, because I felt that's what most people can identify with. You know, we all live for however long. Hopefully, if we're lucky, we love, and we will all lose people. So those were my 3 themes. And when I was actually physically putting it together, I needed to decide whether to just integrate them all throughout or whether to put them in sections. And in the end, I decided to integrate them because that's how life is. Yeah, so putting it together, when I first decided I was going to do it, I had a body of work and I just thought I was going to publish those. But in the course of doing it, I started writing again, and probably 80% of the poems in the book are new poems rather than ancient ones, which I just gathered together from baskets and backs of drawers and in notebooks and whatever. And I started looking at them, and there had enough time had elapsed that I started editing. And it just went from there, really. And then I decided that I would take the shortcut rather than devote 10 years of my life, 10 years that I might not have, for all I know, going the proper route of going in for competitions and et cetera, et cetera. So it's cheating, really. And I'm very fortunate that I could afford to do it. Mm. And I specifically wanted to publish and have it printed in Pembrokeshire, if at all possible. And I did find a Pembrokeshire printer. The work, the physical book is actually printed in Swansea. Mm-hmm. So that was what I did. I mean, because one of my many careers was in publishing, I was production manager for several trade magazines. So I wasn't frightened of the process of getting stuff printed.
Yeah.
I knew about that. I knew that it involves a printer and that I could go to a printer. I didn't for one moment bother to think, oh, I'll get somebody to publish it for me. I knew that I could do it myself.
Well, it's a really lovely volume, and I have let people know that I first met Lou because I was hosting a session at a local literary festival here in West Wales. And Lou was the first poet up in an afternoon of open mic. And she totally knocked it into the park. And afterwards, loads of people came up to me or got in touch via email and said, who was that woman? What was her name? And what was her book? She was fantastic, reading from Life, Love, Loss. Good. Right, should we wind up now? So to sum up, Imtiaz, what do you think, Emma?
I think that she has a voice that is distinctly female, brave, tough, and she really gets to grips with life.
Okay. Yeah, I think the soundbite that she's Pakistani, Muslim, you know, all of that, gets trotted out all the time, but what it's actually saying is, don't categorise me, don't put me in a box. And I think, as I've said earlier on, it's her humanity. Some of it is her mystery. You know, we really don't know anything about her life now.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be fascinated to read her autobiography if she ever gets around to writing one. And yes, I love the fact that she is so cinematic that I do get a picture of her words in my head. I don't know what that funny thing is where you smell things instead of see them. You know, it's a bit like
synesthesia, isn't
that's
it?
That's it. But yes, I just think that her view and her interpretation of the world and how we experience it is unique to her, and she is a gift to us.
Yeah, great. And a poet, a great comfort, I think, in these times where people are looking to poetry for that. Great, thank you ever so much.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, Imtiaz Darker, for giving us a lot of interesting material to talk about. Thank you for listening, and we'll hopefully know you're there in the next episode of the Poetry Pause. Thanks a lot. Bye for now.